This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Hundreds of spectators headed to Capitol Hill yesterday to witness a conversation about America's debt to African Americans. The question at the center of yesterday's historic House hearing, does the government owe black Americans reparations for slavery? It was the first time in over a decade that the House heard testimony on the topic. Reparations has emerged as a big issue for Democratic presidential hopefuls. And whether or not the legislation advances, the hearing marks a change in public thought about the debt to black Americans. William Darity and Kirsten Mullen co-authored a forthcoming book on the issue called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Kirsten is a folklorist and the founder of an arts consulting practice, Artifactual. Kirsten, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And William Sandy Darity is a professor of public policy and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Sandy, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Kirsten, I know you weren't there in Washington, but you were watching the hearings yesterday. What was it like to watch that conversation unfold?
It was actually quite surreal. We've been wondering, what it would take to bring this moment to pass, and to see it actually unfold was quite striking. It was like an out-of-body experience in some ways. We were especially intrigued to see to learn who was selected to provide testimony. And as you know, Sandy was invited to participate. He wasn't able to be there in person, but did send a written testimony.
Sandy, tell us more about the legislation that we're talking about that was at the center of yesterday's hearing.
So this is House Resolution 40, so named because of the unmet promise of 40 acres that was the land grant that was supposed to have gone to the folks who were formerly enslaved at the end of the Civil War. House Resolution 40 is intended to establish a commission that would serve two purposes. The first purpose is to establish the historical record and the litany of wrongs that form the basis for reparations for black American descendants of folks who were enslaved in the United States. And the second purpose is to establish a program of restitution that could be translated into federal legislation.
Right. So it's interesting. This hearing was not about particularly what to do, but about looking into what to do and to establishing a record that you could base any kind of a plan for reparation should you decide to pursue that. You'd have a kind of a record to base that on, right?
Exactly.
And you, Sandy, you and I know Kirsten, in your book, you argue that reparations really a critical way for this country to move forward. Why do you think reparations is so important?
I think that one of the most critical consequences of the trajectory of racial injustice in the United States, and this is inclusive of slavery, where the crucible for the kinds of inequalities that we observe today was formed, but it must also be inclusive of the harms that are associated with 100 years of legal segregation in the United States, the Jim Crow period, as well as ongoing racism that's manifest in police executions of unarmed blacks, mass incarceration, employment discrimination, and then most important from my perspective as an economist, the enormous racial wealth gap, where the average white household has approximately $800,000 more in net worth than the average black household. And it's that staggering differential that I think serves as the primary goal that must be met by a reparations program. And indeed, I'm not sure that there's any other way to eliminate the racial wealth gap than by the development of a comprehensive reparations program.
And you would argue that in terms of our economic, structural economics, both in the development of capitalism on this continent and the way in which slavery played a part in accumulating wealth, and as you say, in the aftermath of slavery, that $800,000 differential that you talk about, the differential in wealth that you talked about, isn't based on current conditions, but a kind of accumulation of wealth over generations. And that's what you're talking about addressing.
Yes, the intergenerational effects of a variety of atrocities and harms.
As you say, there are a number of witnesses yesterday. Let's hear what writer Ta-Nehisi Coates had to say about it.
The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism.
Writer Ta-Nehisi Coates speaking yesterday at a U.S. House hearing into reparations for African Americans. Coates co-authored the 2014 article in The Atlantic on reparations. It is credited with bringing back interest in the issue. I'm joined by Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen, co-authors of a forthcoming book called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. We talked about that article back in 2014, bringing this issue back into consciousness. But Kirsten, this is not something that we're just starting to talk about now. Periodically, this conversation has come up. Talk about the history of the conversation in this country.
Absolutely. You know, African Americans have been talking about, you know, restitution and, you know, being paid for their labor since we came to this country as captives. This is a conversation that is at least 400 years old. There have definitely been spikes when the conversation was more broadly shared. And this is a really, you know, propitious moment for you know, for African Americans today. But absolutely, you know, we were the first abolitionists. We were the, you know, we were actively engaged in our own liberation and seeking citizenship and pursuing every potential avenue that we thought would lead to full citizenship. But we have never been able to achieve it. And this is another moment where we are hoping that, you know, the country at large will do the right thing. And we can dramatically change the trajectory of all citizens in this country.
Sandy, the legislation on the table now, H.R. 40, doesn't get into the particulars of how much or who or how it should be distributed, even if in some ways, but an examination of some of these questions. But in your mind, who should get reparations?
So in my testimony, I refer to two criteria for eligibility for receipt of reparations. The first of the criteria is an individual would have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second criteria is an individual would have to show that for at least 10 years before the enactment of a reparations program or a study commission for reparations, whichever comes first, for at least 10 years before that, they would have had to have self-identified as Black, Negro, or African American. So effectively, there are two standards, a lineage standard that's associated with having ancestry that's connected to someone who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second standard is self-identification with the Black community of the United States.
How do you imagine a reparations program being administered? In your mind, how should it look?
There are some limitations on what I'm able to say about that, because in the final chapter of our forthcoming book, we detail how a reparations program might be executed, and we don't want to risk the wrath of our publisher by revealing everything that's there.
That's why people buy the book. They want to read what you said on public radio to make sure that you were actually telling the truth.
Telling the truth.
You know how many books we sell because people give away the ending, Sandy?
All right. But I can say a couple of things. One is that we do have in some previous work some estimates that we've given of what the magnitude of the fund should be. And the baseline or minimum standard for determining what the magnitude of the fund should be is the present value of 40 acres and a mule. That present value estimate would provide us with some calculation of the wealth that was lost by the formerly enslaved as a consequence of the unfulfilled promise. And the second thing is, there could be a variety of ways in which the fund could be distributed, including some community-based or institution-based projects. But for both substantive and symbolic reasons, we think it's essential that a significant portion of the fund be allocated or distributed as direct payments to eligible recipients.
Well, let's talk about the opposition to this legislation and to the idea of reparations and get into this discussion a little more deeply. I want to hear another clip from yesterday's hearing. This is Republican Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana, who opposes reparations.
Putting aside the injustice of monetary reparations from current taxpayers for the sins of a small subset of Americans from many generations ago, The fair distribution of reparations would be nearly impossible once one considers the complexity of the American struggle to abolish slavery. Just consider this, okay? There are tens of millions of today's non-African Americans who are descended from people who arrived in the country, of course, after slavery ended. And therefore, they can't be held responsible for its legacy. More tens of millions are descended from people in both the North and South who didn't own slaves or who were descended from white people who fought in the Civil War on the Union side. Indeed, only a small percentage of the total American population were slave owners.
Republican Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana yesterday at a House hearing into reparations for African Americans. I'm talking to Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen, co-authors of a forthcoming book with a secret last chapter. The book will be called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Sandy directs the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity in Duke. Kirsten is a folklorist. So what do you make of that? Look, here's the argument. I didn't do it. I shouldn't pay for it. Right? I mean, there's the crux of that argument. Kirsten, what do you think?
So, yeah, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You know, you're asking about the sort of antecedents of this reparations movement. And I wanted to mention, two champions of the movement. One, Dr. Mary Frances Berry, who was the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the author of an excellent book, My Face is Black and True. This was a look at the life of Callie House and the struggle for ex-slave reparations written in 2006. And then also Adjoa Ayotoro, who's a lawyer who worked on the Tulsa Reparations Commission. They created a study to look at possible compensation for the victims of the 1921 Tulsa White Riot. And she was a co-founder of a group called NCOPRA, National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America. But back to this whole question first of, whites freed black people in the Civil War, we should be forever grateful for that. And what I want to say there is, you know, going back to this, the fact that blacks were the founders of the abolitionist movement, they fought for their own liberation from the earliest kidnappings and sale into slavery, but also that, you know, black soldiers fought for and supported the Union. 180,000 black soldiers fought for the Union. A third of them were killed in efforts to keep the states unified and to end slavery. So emancipation was not this gift that was bestowed upon black people. There's a lot of work still to be done.
So part of Mike Johnson's argument was that there were white people who fought for the liberation of African American slaves. But the other part of it is, I didn't do it. Why am I paying for it? That was long ago, far away. I'm a white guy, yeah, but I did not own slaves. I do not own slaves. Why am I paying for this?
I think that's why I emphasized at the beginning of the conversation that the matter of reparations is not exclusively anchored in slavery, that we have to put on the bill of particulars the consequences of nearly a century-long period of legal segregation in the United States, as well as ongoing manifestations of racism. And I highlighted in particular the magnitude of the existing racial wealth gap. So, Representative Johnson and his associates may not feel any sense of responsibility for slavery per se, but Jim Crow is something that occurred that still has living victims. In fact, both Kirsten and I were born into an America where legal segregation was the norm. Now, of course, we could observe the country pursue the denial until death strategy, where you wait until none of us are living, and then you'll say there are no more living victims of Jim Crow. That is a deeply immoral kind of procedure, and it ignores the debt or the obligation that goes beyond the years of slavery into the present moment in the United States. So, and I also want to add, this is not a matter of individual or personal responsibility, which is how the argument seems to frequently be cast. This is a matter of national obligation, because it is federal policy, including the legal apparatus that permitted slavery to be something that could be conducted freely in the United States, as well as permitted Jim Crow and permitted police executions of unarmed blacks in the present moment. It's federal policy which lies at the heart of this, and so it is the federal government that has the obligation to meet the debt.
I also think that, you know, we might consider the fact that while, as Ta-Nehisi Coates and you have pointed out, and others, the victims of this are still alive today very much, the people who are trying then to catch up as a result of this programmatic and systematic inequality are still with us. But also the benefactors are, the beneficiaries, I should say, people who perhaps have gotten a leg up and are benefiting by unearned wealth from generations ago. And if they got to start back at zero, perhaps wouldn't be where they are today. And so examining at least the value of that unearned wealth and where you might be without it, you know, is something probably to take into account. And I wonder, too, what do you think, Sandy, is the actual effect? I mean, how do you think it would help?
How it would help to...
Yeah, well, how would reparations...
reparations program?
Yeah, what effect? I mean, apart from perhaps what you... And you, I think, outlined the moral imperative. This is something that you do morally because of... To redress a wrong and to acknowledge it. But does it have a material impact?
Oh, absolutely. And from my perspective, I think that's the most important impact. One of the key things that we have to keep in mind is the importance of wealth or net worth in terms of human well-being in this society. Wealthier families have greater access to quality neighborhoods, quality schools for their children. They have a greater capacity to leave bequest for the subsequent generations. They have a greater degree of economic security or freedom from economic anxiety, so that if they experience a loss in income, perhaps attributable to a job loss, they have a much greater capability of maintaining their standard of living and maintaining the health of their households. And so, so it is the wealth gap that stands at the heart of this for me. And well-being effects are associated with greater wealth, and that would be one of the material benefits. But we also need to address the adverse effects of employment discrimination, mass incarceration, and police violence. All of these things are destructive of well-being, and they are things that could be altered through a reparations program in such a way that there would be material benefits that are quite substantial.
And Kirsten, beyond that, I know you're also calling for an educational component as well. Tell us about that.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that has really struck us is how much of this history we did not know. And that was actually, you know, our first steps and an ongoing step, actually, is relearning American history. You know, we were not well versed in the systematic work that we're calling dismemory. These organized projects that were aimed at forgetting and distorting the nation's history. There's a 2017 Southern Poverty Center report that reveals that there have been several spikes in these sort of dismemory projects, dismemory project movements. And they follow very closely improvements, you know, changes for the good in the condition of blacks in the U.S. So there's a huge spike around Reconstruction. There's another spike at the beginning of the Board of Education.
Brown versus Board of Education.
But it's stunning just how concentrated these efforts were. You have groups like the United Daughters of the Confederacy stepping in and not just being critical of the history books, but writing their own textbooks and getting authors who had a more accurate view, blackballed.
All right, we're going to have to cut it off there. Kirsten Mullen and Sandy Darity, co-authors of a forthcoming book called From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
We're going to celebrate Black Music Month just ahead on the State of Things. Stay with us.